After 6 years with Illinois Public Media, this is Mark Leonard's last day as general manager. He's leaving the land of Lincoln for Lincoln, Nebraska, to take a job at Nebraska Educational Telecommunications. But before he leaves, he's giving us an exit interview on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and Mark Leonard will be our guest for the first half hour of the show. Then Mark Jerkowitz of the Pew Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism joins us as we talk about a new type of nonprofit news media, web-based nonprofit journalism projects that are trying to fill the gap at a time when newspapers are laying off reporters. That's ahead on Focus. Our program begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. Hi, I'm Jim Meadows, and our apologies if you were expecting our twice-monthly program on Lawn and Garden Care with Sandy Mason. She will be back with us next on Friday, October 9th. Today is a special edition of Focus looking at nonprofit media. That means later in the program, we'll be talking about the new phenomenon of nonprofit journalism organizations. But right now, the nonprofit media we're talking about is the one you're listening to. WILL, Illinois Public Media, has been managed for the past 6 years by Mark Leonard, but today is his last day as general manager. He's leaving to become general manager and CEO at Nebraska Educational Telecommunications, where he will oversee a statewide network of public radio and TV stations, plus their netnebraska.org website. But before he goes, we wanted to talk to him about his time here at WILL and what he sees ahead for public media. And we'll take your calls at 333-9455 or take them toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. Mark, welcome back to Focus.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
And 6 years doesn't seem like that long a time. We've had general managers who stayed here for decades.
Well, actually, it was 7 years. Just a little bit over 7 years. No, you have had some longevity in your leadership, and frankly, I was a little surprised to be leaving at this point. It was not something that I was considering doing. But Nebraska is a very respected organization, and
they headhunted you.
They did, and I was very honored to be approached by them. So, if it were not such a great opportunity, I would not be leaving Illinois.
Well, even during 7 years, there have been some changes here in WILL, and there's been changes in public broadcasting across the country as a whole. I'm just wondering, what are the big changes that are happening to the field in your view?
Well, I think there are changes in the media field in general. There are changes in terms of the field of journalism. There are changes in terms of public policies as they relate to tax support. And there was an economic collapse that was thrown in the middle of it, which reordered a lot of people's priorities and strategies and thoughts about all sorts of things. So the last 7 years have been far from dull for WILL, have been far from dull for the media industry. I think when we talk about consumer behavior, the technology in the last 7 years has really given viewers and listeners many more choices and also much more control over how they use media. And that for broadcasters like us and for our commercial counterpoints, that's something that we are struggling to figure out what to do with that. The idea that a broadcast signal you pick up on a radio is, I wouldn't say it's quaint yet, but it's certainly it's competing with the internet and tablets and mobile devices, and increasingly people are using that to access content.
And I think more and more people who listen to radio programming on a radio, and certainly people who watch television programming on a TV with an antenna, is just not so much anymore.
Well, that's true. And certainly demographically, we can see that the younger the viewer or listener, the more they are using these alternate devices and alternate delivery methods. And that's something that we ignore at our own peril.
Well, the public broadcasting model, I think, was based on scarcity in the 1960s, the idea that a market might have three or four channels, and that was TV, for instance. And there were commercial pressures on TV, so there needed to be another channel set aside that would try something different. And it needed to have some federal funding. And that's what public broadcasting has today, both in TV and radio. But yet, there's a lot more choices out there. So the question is, how does what's the case for public broadcasting today?
Well, I think at one time there was the assumption that the reason for public television and to some extent public radio was that it was a scarcity and it was needed as an alternative to fill those niches that were not being filled by commercial broadcasting. The Newton Minow speech always comes to mind about, you know, wires in the box and vast wasteland. And in that climate, public broadcasting looked very, very much different. And then when the cable began to explode and DBS satellite, there became many, many more channels. And for a period of time, I think that a lot of people truly believed that it would replace some of the signature genres that public broadcasting owned up to that point, whether it be cultural or history or science or some of those kinds of strands. And so channels like the Learning Channel and Discovery and Biography and Bravo and Arts and Entertainment, you know, were launched. And they, I think, at one time had some very, very lofty ambitions. If you look at the schedule now of those channels, if you pull out a TV grid and look at what's on Discovery or A&E or any of those cable channels today, those titles really don't describe what they're broadcasting. They are not not producing high quality performance, culture, arts programming. They're not doing deep science. You're seeing programs like Duck Dynasty and Ice Road Truckers and Housewives of Atlanta and all sorts of other things that bear no resemblance to public broadcasting. So over the last 20 years or 25 years, I think that public broadcasting found that far from being a model on its way out, the content that we produce is even more unique and stands as even more of an example of the difference between nonprofit journalism and nonprofit media and a for-profit media model, which is solely about large audiences and advertising.
Is that, has that been borne out both in audience levels and also the ability to raise money?
Well, it has. You know, I think that, public radio has had a tremendous growth in audience over the last two decades. Public television was in decline in audience, but it was never dropping as rapidly as commercial broadcast was. And over the last 2 years, we have seen a reversal of that decline, and public television audiences are growing. And you can point to a couple of series in particular that have had just, you know, stellar audiences. Downton Abbey over the last two seasons has broken new records for public television. But before that, Antiques Roadshow was garnering numbers that were significant and, again, growing in terms of market share. So I think that it's being rediscovered by many because of its uniqueness and because of the great quality programming that public broadcasting offers.
You may not see classical music concerts on A&E anymore, but on the other hand, there's the Internet and a lot of things you can get there, a lot of things which you can get on download, a lot of video that's now coming through there. That really increases the variety and the options beyond a way that, say, cable television would.
Well, something that I think gets overlooked sometimes is that there is distribution, and that's one piece of the puzzle, but then there's also content creation. And there is a fallacy that content, that if you can access the connectivity, if you can get the distribution piece, that means it's free if it's on the Internet. Someone has to produce the material, and the ability for public broadcasters, whether it's radio or television, to pool their dollars into a programming co-op is what produces the programs like Great Performances or the concerts that we hear on Evening Concert or any of those kinds of genres. Those types of program content engines are what are in jeopardy when people start thinking that content is free.
When we talk about jeopardy, I wanted to ask you how the funding picture is today for WILL. And I say, I always hear wonderful things here at this station about how we're doing during fund drives and how we are raising money from our viewers and listeners. But when we look at the total funding picture, including state support and the University of Illinois, which owns the station, and federal funding, how do things look?
Well, the bright spot for a long time for WILL has been our local membership support, and that has steadily increased over the years, and we wrapped up this past year with one of the highest fundraising totals ever, if not the highest total ever. So that has been gratifying, and that has been the strength of the multi-legged funding stool. Federal funding has been relatively flat, although certainly every year has gotten a lot of attention as bills have been introduced to either restrict or eliminate funding for public broadcasting. We can never take that for granted, and so we do spend a lot of time making sure that our supporters know when our funding is being discussed or being considered. But so far, it has remained at least steady. The funding from the state of Illinois has declined. And in fact, among states that still fund public broadcasting at all, Illinois is at the very bottom of that list with about 14 cents per capita.
And many states, you say, do not do any funding except what may come through, like state university
licenses. Well, I wouldn't say that most. I'd say most states do fund public broadcasting, but that we're at the very bottom of that list. And then there's a handful of states that offer no funding for public broadcasting. But then there are some states that are very, very generous and are.
How's Nebraska, by the way?
Nebraska is very strong. Nebraska is funded with about $10 million per year from the legislature, which is $4 and change per capita. So in that state, the support has been steady and strong for them. Iowa is another state that funds at a very, very high level and has been relatively secure. As far as university support, we have been very fortunate. The University of Illinois has provided cash support and in-kind support for WILL that has been strong and relatively steady, but declining over the years. And I think that at this point, as the university continues to look at its own funding model with declining or threatened support from the state of Illinois, they're doing some deep exploration in terms of what is the sustainability and the sustainable budget models for the university. And we have to be concerned at Illinois Public Media where we will be funded from in the university and under what sort of mechanism. And that is something that is being thought about a lot right now. The university is moving increasingly to being a tuition-supported university with less and less reliance on the general revenue support. Now, without saying whether that's good or bad, I will tell you that it is the general revenue funds that are the portion of university support that WILL receives. So that's something that again, should be will be watched increasingly over the coming years.
So you don't think that we can assume there will be university funding or at the same level, say, 10 years from now?
I think it would be very smart for WILL and the university to articulate what is the role of public broadcasting for the University of Illinois and what is the funding model separate from tuition that will help to support it and at what level so that WILL can plan accordingly what its long-term strategy is. I will say that we have been very, very fortunate here to weather the economic downturn without WILL accumulating any operating debt or any operating deficit. And that puts us in a pretty small class of stations nationally. Over three quarters of the public television stations cannot claim the same. They have deficits and they have debt as a result of funding shortfalls. We've been very conservative here, and I would say very responsible, which puts us in a strong position. There are other stations in this state and across the country that are pretty precarious right now.
I know seeing in the news a few years ago when WTVP in Peoria was essentially teetering on the edge with debts they had in connection with their new building. And I think they've weathered that, but I guess that would be an example of some of the challenges these stations face.
Absolutely. And we all faced on the television side the cost of the digital conversion, which was not fully supported by the federal government or the state government. And we as an industry accumulated a lot of debt complying with that mandated change.
Even getting part of it done, we still don't have digital cameras.
We do not. We are analog cameras here, and radio is very analog here also. The audio consoles that your show is produced on every year are probably 20, 25 years old.
These were audio consoles that were moved into this building in the late 1990s.
Absolutely.
From Gregory Hall to Campbell Hall.
So the work is not done at this point.
This is Focus on WILL, and we're talking with Mark Leonard on his last day as the general manager of Illinois Public Media. And as we talk about the challenges that public broadcasting faces and WILL faces, it's can't avoid the fact that we here at Illinois Public Media are a smaller organization than we were just a few years ago. And this was a reduction that started before you came here. But some of the cutbacks are things that listeners and viewers might not notice. Some of them represent genuine efficiencies, and some of them just meant we've had to cut back on what we do here. We do less local talk programming, for example, on radio. We no longer have a weather department. Our local TV production staff has been cut back, pending funding for specific projects. Mark, can you talk about some of the circumstances leading to the decisions to make these cutbacks?
The circumstances were largely declines in the State Arts Council funding, which over the span of 2 to 3 years, we lost about $300,000 in support. And frankly, that money was being used for mostly local production. And local production is actually, for both radio and television, the most expensive content that WILL broadcasts. It's a lot cheaper to license a nationally or regionally produced program than it is to mount the effort to fill a half hour or an hour on the air once a week or every day in the case of a Focus, for example. So we did have to cut back some of the television content and on the radio side, primarily the weather service. If we had not cut that, the number of national shows that we would have had to have cut to offset that would have been significant. At the same time, we were able to restore some programs that had been cut previously. The one that comes to mind is Fresh Air, that a lot of our listeners had clamored for, and we were able to bring that back into the schedule. But every year, the budget exercise is one of looking at what you would like to be able to schedule, what you have in available funds, and any sort of changes in the funding support from the previous year. And I would love to see a growing budget. We have not had the luxury, nor has any broadcaster, public broadcaster that I know of, a growing budget in this current climate. We are looking long term for how we can restore that and grow the local content, and we are hopefully building from a foundation of strong radio production and strong news production that we think will allow us to grow and also to build from that broadcast radio platform into online and television content as well.
Well, what do you think local public media outfits, including this one, can do in the way of original programming these days, considering all these limitations? How do you go laying down the groundwork for new projects? And I'm sure that's a challenge you'll have at Nebraska, even though it's a larger organization, as they figure out how to do their local programming.
I think that it's important when you start looking at, again, the changes in how people are using media, it becomes clear that the national content people will be able to receive without a local station. You'll be able to go and get a podcast. We already can get a podcast of Wait, Don't Tell Me, or a lot of the syndicated content. So our challenge is to say, what is it that we're able to produce that is different or augments the national content or provides a unique service for the region that we are in? I would say, for example, that our agricultural programming is an example of that, that very few stations across the country have the level of commitment to agricultural reporting that WILL does. That reflects the needs of our area, the interest of our area, and even a role that the university plays as a land-grant university that is perfectly appropriate for us. So it's those kinds of sweet spots of need and opportunity, I think, where we should be focusing efforts going forward. Journalism, absolutely. What has happened in the world of news and journalism is daunting. It's upsetting. The commercial models for news generation, whether it is broadcast or print, have been turned on their ears. And I think your guest in the second half of the show is going to talk about that. But what has been emerging is are examples of where nonprofit journalism centers are beginning to take up some of the slack of what was being previously provided by commercial journalism models. And I think that there is a very strong role for Illinois Public Media in that area.
We have a caller on line one. I want to go to Michael from Urbana. Michael, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I wanted to start with a simple factual question for Mr. Leonard. Does NET have a statewide newscast in the evenings or
on television or on radio?
On television.
They do not on television. Most of their journalism effort is on their radio side, and they have a pretty robust radio news department.
Okay. And that was just sort of broadly where I was going with this. Do you think that public television has anything like the kind of resources available to help make up the gap in local news coverage, or is that burden mainly going to fall to radio reporters?
I think that there is a role, and in fact, something that's coming this fall is that the NewsHour on public television is expanding into a 7-day-a-week broadcast. And on the weekends, they will be providing a local cut-in window. Now, that's not every night of the week, but it will free up some time within that format for local stations if they choose to do some reporting in their own area of their own choice. It may be a news headline, may be a week in review, it may be investigative. But I think that is a watershed moment for taking the signature PBS news content and finding a way of integrating for stations that choose to some local content into it.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't seem as if public television has often had the resources, especially to get out of the studio. I'm thinking of when I lived up in Chicago, and WTTW has Chicago Tonight, but they're almost always just kind of Carol Marine in a studio with talking with people. They don't really have too many stories from the street, as it were. So anyway, thank you very much, and thank you for your work helping WLL keep going.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And, you know, his mention of Chicago Tonight on WTTW, that grew out of an attempt at more of a conventional TV newscast. I remember the late John Calloway running that broadcast, and they started trying to be something that looked like a TV newscast, only from the public television standpoint. And you could see that they didn't have much money. They just could not send people out and go places and get things put together with the same sort of flexibility that the commercial TV operations had.
They don't. It's been interesting to watch. There's one station in the public broadcast family, KPBS San Diego, which is a joint licensee that is also licensed to South Dakota State University, that is betting the farm on a local journalism model. And they are putting all of their efforts, their staff, their fundraising efforts behind a multi-platform news effort in that market. And a lot of stations and a lot of people in the industry are watching it very closely to see if they can sustain that.
And at the same time, I don't know what sort of role these things play, but you can look at stations as close as WEIU in Charleston to WSIU down in Carbondale and to what this station, WILL-TV, did, I think, 40 years ago with newscasts that rely on the talents of student reporters. Now, these sort of broadcasts are certainly in one-step training exercises for the students involved, but that seems to be one way to get something on the air that might be of use to viewers.
It could be. My own opinion is that this market is pretty heavily served by, again, commercial providers in terms of a daily newscast. Where I think that there might be more opportunity is for some regional reporting and deeper reporting out of Springfield, out of the capital. The commercial broadcasters and the commercial print media have pulled their staffs out of it. They don't maintain bureaus there anymore. And I don't think anyone would argue that we have enough reporting on politics in the state of Illinois. And that could be a role that public radio and public television, perhaps as a joint project, could undertake an increased presence in.
Before we go into a break, quick call, line one, Paul in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Well, I was very distressed to see the Jane Mayer article about WNET New York and the whole brouhaha with Combs, with Cock, Citizen Cock, the film. I don't know. It's maybe a little inside baseball, but it seems like that will have a chilling effect on all of the PBS. You know, they basically pulled the Independent Lens.
This was the Independent Lens documentary about the, I think about the Koch brothers.
Right, but it was the preamble to it was WNET gave Koch, who was on the board of directors of WNET and resigned and didn't give the $7 million he was planning on giving, because there was this other documentary that came right out at WNET called Park Avenue, which contrasted the really palatial condo that he and Koch and Schumer lived in with the people that live on the other end of Park Avenue, which is, you know, an impoverished zip code, one of the very impoverished area in New York City. And so he took his money and went, and it's just part of the whole context of corporate influence on PBS. And I really don't know. I mean, a British model, isolating. It just seems to me the self-censorship that's going on inside of PBS. Koch gets his name on Nova all the time, and I noticed quite a bit a distinction between their reporting on global warming vis-a-vis the BBC's science flagship documentary over the years. And it's just, it's such a big concept, and maybe the person in the next hour will have something to say about that, even though he's actually talking about the alternatives to the production idea. So anyway, that's a little inchoate, but I really recommend people learn about that story because it does point out the problems that are going on right now and in our media, and even, you know, some of the best of our media, which is generally PBS.
Well, Paul, Paul, thank you for the call. And
very
I'm
good.
Thinking
thank you.
I can think of cases that go back decades where there are essentially political conflicts over things broadcast on public broadcasting. And the long-term complaint from conservatives about public broadcasting is that they feel it is biased.
Well, and vice versa, liberals think that it's being shut out by corporate interests. It's an interesting dilemma. I think that it's dangerous to paint it all with too broad a brush. WNET is a locally licensed station. PBS is a national organization that they're a member of. I share your concern about the specifics and the perceptions around that issue. I share your concerns that we do not damage the public trust in terms of our impartiality. And I think that that's something that we in the industry have to watch very, very closely as we look for non-governmental sources of funding to offset declines in those areas. I think that your reference to the BBC model is a very worthwhile one. Unfortunately, we never have had that level of support in the United States. From the very beginning, the federal funding was only a start, and then the local stations augmented that with other fundraising methods. It's important to have a very strong firewall between the funding and the content, and that's something that, you know, that this station believes deeply in and that I personally believe in. And I think the WNET example is a good cautionary tale.
We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll return with a conversation about nonprofit journalism and a look at the organizations which have sprung up around the country, even as traditional newsrooms have cut back on reporting staffs. This is Focus on WILL. Take WILL with you anywhere you go. If you have an iPhone, iPad, or Android device, just head to the App Store or Google Play and search for WILL Radio. The new WILL app is free and allows you to stream our AM and FM stations, listen to past episodes of your favorite programs on demand, and much more. And we're back on Focus on WILL. And that message is being one taste of the sort of changes in technology which are just happening all over the place and affecting how public broadcasting works and the ocean it swims in, so to speak. We're back on Focus with Mark Leonard, our departing general manager at WILL. And later on, we'll ask him for some final thoughts as he prepares for a new position at Nebraska Educational Telecommunications. But right now, our focus is on nonprofit journalism. Of course, public broadcasting provides us with nonprofit journalism through NPR News and the PBS NewsHour and so forth. They're not money-making ventures, to the best of my knowledge, but in the last few years, as traditional newsrooms have cut back on reporting staff, new organizations have sprung up, usually based online. They may not be part of a traditional media outlet, but they're devoted to reporting news that they believe traditional media can no longer cover. Mark Jerkowitz is on the line with us. He's Associate Director of the Pew Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism and the co-author of a report issued last month by the center called Nonprofit Journalism, a Growing but Fragile Part of the U.S. News System. Mark Jerkowitz, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to be with you.
And your study actually lists a nonprofit journalism project here in Champaign-Urbana that WILL works with. It's CU Citizen Access. It's run out of the University of Illinois Department of Journalism. Its work has appeared both here in WILL and our website, will.illinois.edu, and at the News Gazette newspaper in town, and also at the Chicago Spanish language newspaper, Hoy Chicago. And looking at their website, I see they rely on funding and grants from a mix of for-profit and nonprofit sources, and its staff is tiny. Mark, is that a typical sample of the nonprofit journalism sector?
Well, yes, it is. And actually, when we're talking about the nonprofit journalism sector that we looked at in this study, we were looking at a specific part of it, not public media per se, but these almost all of them online-only news organizations, most of which have sprouted up in the past 5 years, that are, interestingly enough, sort of pursuing a kind of a niche editorial model. They're not trying to replicate all of the functions of your local television broadcast or radio broadcast or a newspaper. They are focused on sort of specific areas where they largely think a void has been created by sort of the reductions in legacy media staffing. And yes, perhaps the most fundamental finding that we had, and what we did was we surveyed close to 100 of these organizations, is that by and large, they are quite small. About three-quarters of them had full-time staff of five or less. Now, it's worth noting that they also, many of them, had part-time staffers, and a lot of them had volunteer staffers. But it does speak to, in some degree, the fragility and kind of the newness of this form and this player in the media ecosystem.
Can you name any notable examples, maybe ones that are working on a national scale, of nonprofit journalism groups?
Certainly, first of all, it's worth noting that several of these nonprofit news organizations, relatively new, have won Pulitzer Prizes. In fact, Inside Climate News won one this very past year. And perhaps when people think of this genre, if they're paying attention, probably the best-known name is ProPublica, which is a large, relatively speaking, large investigative journalism organization based in New York, began with a $10 million grant from a wealthy San Francisco funder. Its first editor was Paul Steiger, who is very well known as the highly respected managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. They do very good work. They're quite well known. They're an outlier in sort of their assets and resources. And another one that I think people may be accustomed to hearing about is the Texas Tribune, which is also a large and very, in terms of its coverage, politically oriented nonprofit news organization down in Texas. MinnPost in Minnesota is fairly well known. The Voice of San Diego is an experiment that I think people have heard about. So there are a handful of names that may pop to mind for people who follow the industry most closely, but by and large, the folks that responded to our survey are not well known. Perhaps within their communities, they're working in the trenches. To some degree, they live hand to mouth, and they're really trying to build a business model going forward.
Are some of these obviously partisan organizations? Do they have a political axe to grind?
Some of them do. We have, and we did an earlier study about that, and some of them clearly, both on the left and on the right, have a partisan agenda. They produce news from a certain kind of perspective. They also, we found in an earlier study, tend to be less transparent about where they're getting their funding from than other of these organizations. But and there's obviously room for ideological media everywhere in the news universe, as long as people sort of know where you're coming from. But the good news is that by and large, in the sector that we examine and the examples we examine, we see people who are fundamentally producing what we would the traditional model of sort of straightforward news. A lot of, by the way, investigative journalism coming from these organizations. Some coverage of issues like, for example, healthcare or the environment. And in some communities where, and I know you were just speaking in the last segment about, reporters not being at city halls and state houses the way they were, in some communities, these organizations have tried to pick up the slack by focusing on local government in a way that the local newspaper, for example, may not anymore.
Well, okay. And I'm wondering, if most of these are web-based, how do they get their content out? Do they just have the websites to go with, or do they often work with other media outlets?
Well, they obviously, disseminate much of their content through their website. ProPublica is well known for working with other media partners. And frankly, the big question that we tried to get at in getting some of the financial data from these organizations is, can they build a sustainable model, business model going forward? Almost two-thirds of the organizations that we surveyed began with a major startup grant that accounted for at least a third of their initial budget. So to a great degree, these places were started with a big grant. And what's going to happen over time is that these grants are going to dry up. And what they've given these organizations is time to be able to try and diversify their revenue streams. But at some point, the training wheels are going to come off. And these organizations are going to have built their own business model that's not as reliant on a single big funder. One of the ways they can do that, candidly, is by partnering with other media organizations, the franchising, syndicating their content. That's frankly one of the options they have for building this business model. And I do think, and you mentioned it yourself, that there are increasingly going to be partnerships between these nonprofit news organizations and other nonprofit news organizations or traditional legacy for-profit organizations.
Well, in going over the report, to use some old newspaper lingo, a lot of these groups sound like they're all church but not much state, and that they may not know at this point about the aspects of how to market their product and just how to get it seen by places and how to get money out of it.
Well, that's correct. We asked people, frankly, what the biggest need they had going forward was, and the biggest need identified by these organizations was the need for a strong business side operation. As you can imagine, most of these places were actually founded by journalists, sometimes journalists laid off or who had previously worked at legacy publications in their markets. You don't generally see entrepreneurs say, yeah, I want to go into the nonprofit sector because I can make a ton of money. So you basically had kind of editorial people building these places and not enough of the requisite business side skills that are necessary. One of the reasons that happens, and we interviewed some folks who are sort of analysts in the nonprofit sector, is there's kind of this self-perpetuating sense that nonprofit organizations, period, are often rated and judged by the percentage of their revenue that goes to program services, i.e., in this case, the journalism, as opposed to administrative costs. And most nonprofits are incentivized for minimizing administrative costs. And the news nonprofits, the same thing, and basically using all their money on journalism. The problem is, as a lot of these analysts will say, you need to build these administrative costs to create the business side and get the business side expertise you need to market, to use the website properly, to find new revenue sources. And unfortunately, they're not incentivized to do this, so we've got a little bit of a catch-22 going on here.
A lot of these organizations, are they being read by the general public, or if they're not finding a mainstream media outlet, or are they maybe more being read by other journalists who may draw on their content for other stories?
Well, we asked a question, and we don't have any way of verifying this, obviously, in the survey about whether or not their web traffic was growing, and a large majority said yes. Depending on what they're covering, they may actually, be developing an audience within their own geographic community, or they may be developing an office along the broader communities of interest that don't know geographic boundaries. At this point, it is hard to know in most cases how impactful they are, how well read they are in their communities of interest or their geographic communities. But ultimately, for the people who think about this, I think there is a strong belief that for these folks to succeed, and be part of the media ecosystem. And they could fulfill a very important function down the road. They are going to need to build a financial base, not among, you know, the MacArthur Foundation necessarily or the Knight Foundation, but among their essentially their own loyal subscribers or readers. They're going to have to be funded to a large extent by folks who read their content, appreciate their content, and to some degree are willing to subsidize their content.
You know, I'm thinking, and Mark Leonard, this is something I wanted to ask you about as far as a public broadcaster. Of course, we know about the work that CU Citizen Access does with WYLL, but are there other instances? Does your new employer, Nebraska Educational Telecommunications, do anything with outside journalism organizations in the nonprofit realm in some sort of cooperative?
Well, the one that I think I'm most familiar with is something called Harvest Public Media, and they are part of that local journalism partnership that are collectively reporting on issues affecting agriculture in general. I know that WUIS, our counterpart in Springfield, is a member of Harvest Public Media, as are several other radio and television broadcasters. I know of that one because it's a fairly large and has been established. And in fact, I think we're even running a production tonight on WILL that they produced and some of their stories on radio. I know they're in discussion with other ones. I'm not sure how many are up and operating at this point. But I think that for them, they are exploring, again, how do we sustain and adapt the journalism model in the climate that we are in, the cards that we've been dealt, and they are looking to partners there.
Okay. Mark Cherkowitz, I'm wondering, most people in journalism are usually not in it for the money, but what sort of living can you make working in nonprofit journalism? I mean, is this a big part of the career choices facing J-school graduates today?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think most people don't, you know, I think most people don't get into journalism for the money, although, you know, at one point, let's be honest, there was a clear sort of career path you could follow, particularly if you were, let's say, a print journalist, where, you know, you started at a small paper, you went to a bigger paper, and you finally ended up at a big Metro Daily, and, you know, it was a pretty good living. I think these days, J-school professors are probably telling their students a lot of things, including, well, now that you no longer need to be tethered to a major news organization to have the means of production, you might want to start thinking about being your own individual brand out there. I think that there are, you know, we've obviously looked at the finances these organizations provided us with, and there are some of these organizations are pretty well heeled, and there's no doubt that the bigger ones are providing a good living for journalists, and some of them very veteran journalists who have been around for a while and are accustomed to making decent salaries. But on the other hand, I think, you know, when we're looking at an average full-time staff of five or less, you know, you're talking about folks who, to some degree, are driven by passion. And, you know, it's not that nonprofits can't make more money, you know, can't show a surplus at the end of a year, but it obviously has to be plowed back into the operation. But I do think that for a lot of these news organizations, it's a labor of love for people who are, you know, very committed to what they're doing. And again, who really do see, and I can't stress this enough, think that they're one of the reasons that their journalism is viable is because legacy media just can't do as much as it used to. We just saw the American Society of Newspaper Editors do its annual census of full-time newsroom employees. It was down another 6%. This is the first time since they started counting in 1978 that there are less than 40,000 full-time employees. We know that the local newspaper has constricted. It's not covering what it used to cover. And so a lot of these organizations began with the belief that they will be able to sustain themselves because they are producing news that is becoming more and more extinct elsewhere.
And are you seeing any organizations? You mentioned that a lot of them were still working on their seed money, but do you see any organizations which have made it to the stage two, essentially, and look to have some stability?
Yes. I mean, it's interesting because as fragile as these news organizations are, there are some real good signs that we got from the survey data. One is, you know, there's a high level of optimism. I mean, people, about 80% of the people who responded were optimistic that they would be, you know, solvent 5 years down the road. Now, some of that is psychological, I think, understandably. If you're engaged in an effort like this and you're working that hard, you obviously need to believe in the effort. But we, you know, we found a significant number of these organizations that had generated more revenue than they had spent the previous year. We also asked about the issue of cash reserves. In other words, how much cash would you have on hand right now in terms of how long could it sustain you? And, you know, a lot of these organizations said something like 3 to 6 months, which we initially said, wow, that doesn't sound like much. But then we talked to folks in the nonprofit sector who analyzed the nonprofit sector and said, you know what, in the nonprofit sector, that's not bad. So the answer is that there are a number of these organizations that are doing well enough at this point to, you know, to create hope that they can sustain themselves down the road. We found, for example, that a majority of the organizations that we surveyed had now developed at least three different kinds of revenue streams. But the bad news within that is that even among those, they were mostly reliant on a single stream for about 75% of their income. So they're at this moment are not at phase two, by and large. They're working very hard to get there. And in some ways, what they're doing is just this, it reflects what's going on in the larger media culture with the advertising model very much disrupted, both in the newspaper and television industry. People are trying to come up with new revenue streams. Everybody knows there will have to be more of them, to sort of help recoup that lost advertising money that's probably not coming back. And on a nonprofit level, you've got these organizations fundamentally trying to recoup the foundation money that's probably not coming back.
Well, Mark Jerkowitz, it looks like a trend to watch, and we invite people to come to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus, where you'll find a link to the report from the Pew Center on nonprofit journalism. And Mark Jerkowitz, thank you very much for being on the program with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I want to save our last few minutes on Focus today for Mark Leonard, our departing general manager, and just wanted to ask you, Mark, just after your 7 years here, what do you think is ahead for Illinois Public Media with all the uncertainties in terms of how funding may work out in the future, are the changes in the media landscape? What advice would you have for the next general manager here to get WILL positioned to stay fiscally healthy and provide a genuine service?
Well, I think that Illinois Public Media has a wonderful history and legacy. It's an early station. It's a strong station. It was there at the beginning when public broadcasting was founded. In fact, it precedes that all the way back to the AM license back to 1922 and the FM license in the 40s, and then the Allerton Summit in the late 40s, where some of the principles of domestic U.S. public broadcasting were hammered out. It has a great legacy, but it needs to be looking forward and be willing to adapt because the models are changing. The models, as we just heard from Mark a few minutes ago in journalism, are adapting and changing faster than we would have ever predicted. I think that the usage patterns of what people want and what they need are changing, and that we, WILL, will be best served by making sure that it is embedded in the communities that it serves, that it understands what matters in this area, and that it helps to provide a forum for the communities, that it helps to provide a mirror for the communities, that they can see themselves and their issues, and that it brings together the forces of a local media organization on behalf of bettering our community. So some of it's related to newscasts, but some of it's related also to arts and culture and ways that we can celebrate the things in our region that inspire us. And Live and Local is a program that we've created over the last couple of years, which I'm very, very proud of, because it begins to give us a way to bring some of our local performing arts community into our studio and for us to support and celebrate what we do locally. What we do in education, I think, is fantastic, that the idea that public media is returning to its role in educating people of all ages is one that I think has a rich future as people look for online learning and using technology outside of the classroom for everything from preschoolers to retirees. We have a role in all of those areas, and I think it's a role that can expand and grow. So, you know, my advice is, I guess, to know this community as well as possible and to be engaged in helping to support the region and to expand some of the great expertise of the University of Illinois and bring that to the general populace.
Well, Mark Leonard, best of luck at Nebraska. And don't forget the Illini football team plays the Cornhuskers at Memorial Stadium in Lincoln on October 5th, game time 11 a.m. So maybe that's time to remember Illinois. At that
I wonder
time.
Which color I should wear.
That's just one of those little battles you'll have to figure out for yourself.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Thank you for being with us these last few years. Best of luck in Nebraska, and thanks for being on Focus today. And our thanks also to Mark Jerkowitz of the Pew Research Center, co-author of a new study on nonprofit journalism, which you can read at our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. And we're likely the first result in your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show, produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. On Monday, an encore edition of Focus, What Makes You Happy? Can You Quantify and Study It? We'll hear from Ed Diener, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Illinois. He's written extensively about what factors influence psychological health and well-being. That's on Monday's show. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear us over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs on demand. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.